Welcome to the New Life Podcast, a ministry of New Life Presbyterian Church in Ithaca, New York. Join us for worship each week at 10 o'clock at 950 Danby Road, Ithaca, New York. You can also visit us on our website, www.newlifeithaca.org.
Welcome to the Midweek Podcast, a sometimes production of New Life Presbyterian Church. We are in the midst of a sermon series on Galatians, and as promised, I wanted to give some more in-depth material that would not be appropriate for a sermon, but is still important for our journey through Galatians. So today we're going to talk about the life of Paul leading up to the writing of the letter. We're going to talk about some of the circumstances of the letter. And we're also going to talk about the actual letter itself and the manuscript holdings, where these texts actually are located and what they date to, which is an important piece of information so that we can have confidence in what we are reading. So let's start with the life of Paul. We don't know exactly when Paul was born. He doesn't discuss or give a date for it. Most scholars would say that he was born sometime between 5 BC and 5 AD, probably toward the latter end of that. We do know that he was born and raised in Tarsus, a city in modern-day Turkey, on the southern coast. Tarsus was a rather large and metropolitan city. It was a Roman city. It later, and during Paul's lifetime, became a part of the Roman province of Syria. The Roman Empire was always restructuring the various jurisdictions and provinces. We know that Paul was highly educated in Tarsus. Tarsus was a city not unlike Ithaca, with a major educational institution. The quality of education given there was on par with anything else you'd find in the Roman Empire. The distinction between Tarsus and Paris, which is the first European university. The distinction between Tarsus and Athens, being that Athens was more famous because it had more outside scholars. But Paul was very well educated there. He was educated, as we'll get into in a little bit later point, according to the pattern of the Greek schools. Tarsus was also a heavy center of trade, given its location. And just a little bit in from the ocean, but with a navigable river, it was a great place for goods to be moved inland and to come from the inward regions to the sea. So let's talk about Paul's name. We talked about when he was born, where he was born. What about his name? Paul had two names, which would have been the practice of many Jewish people at the time, especially if they lived in Greco-Roman areas. His Hebrew name was Shaul, or Saul, named for King Saul, evidently. He was of the tribe of Benjamin, which is the same tribe that King Saul was a part of, which seems to be significant typologically, as if Paul is the redeemed New Covenant version of Saul, who is supporting the heir of David instead of trying to persecute. Well, begins persecuting the heir of David just like Saul, but is converted and begins to support the heir of David, the anointed. His Greek name was Paul, Paulos. And I don't think we need to draw a distinction of he was called Saul until he was converted and then he started being called Paul. That's not really at all what the situation was. He had two names, Saul, which he would have went by around Hebrew-speaking people, and Paul, which he would have went by around Greek-speaking people. And so the distinction is that when Paul began to do outreach to the Greek areas, he started going as Paul. Now, Paul's parents, or perhaps his grandparents, had done something very important for Paul's life. It really helped him out significantly in his mission to the Gentiles. At some point, either Paul's parents or grandparents had obtained Roman citizenship. This was possible for non-Romans to obtain. It was possible even for Jewish people to obtain. It is assumed, or this is one thing that is theorized, and I think it makes a lot of sense, that Paul's parents or grandparents had gained the approval or the patronage of a previous emperor or general of the Roman armies because they were tent makers, and tent making being very important for military campaigns. So the theory goes that Paul's parents or grandparents obtained Roman citizenship, so Paul was born a Roman citizen, which becomes very important in his life and his story. As I said before, Paul was educated in the Greek schools in Tarsus. He exhibits an intimate knowledge of Greco-Roman philosophers and poets. He is fluent in both Greek and Hebrew, not only the language but the culture. The Greek culture and the Hebrew culture. He is a true multicultural person, which enables him to move in between the Greek and the Hebrew worlds and the Greek-speaking Jewish world with ease. At some point, Paul's parents moved him to Jerusalem to escape what they considered to be the bad influence of Tarsus. And they enrolled him in Jerusalem with the top rabbi, whose name was Gamaliel. This is like if someone were to study classics at Cornell and then go to grad school at Harvard Divinity. Paul was at the top of the heap, highly educated, well-trained, with the best scholars and in the best schools. Gamaliel now was a moderate rabbi, likely of the Hillel school. I'll talk about that in a second. We see his moderation when he gives his advice to the Sanhedrin in Acts chapter 5, not to oppose Peter and John because they might be found to be opposing God. Gamaliel's speech is recorded in Acts 5, 34 through 39, and the Sanhedrin followed his advice and stopped trying to hinder Peter and John. Paul, however, came to adhere to a more strict form of Pharisaism, which was the school of Shammai. Shammaiite interpretation was almost always stricter than Hillelite, but in some respects we would say it was more biblical. One example being divorce. According to the Hillel school, a man could divorce his wife if she displeased him, say, by burning his supper. But according to the Shammaiite school, divorce could only occur in very serious or grave circumstances, which would be more toward the biblical position that we hold to today. Shammaiites taught that one transgression of the Torah was a transgression of the entire Torah. And this is the biggest clue that Paul was a part of the Shammaiite school, because they believed, along with the Essenes, that any transgression of the law was not just the transgression of that little part, but a breaking of the entire Torah. And this idea comes into Galatians, as we will see in the coming weeks. Paul references it in other places in his letters. And also, the letter of James, the author of James, seems to be also referencing this idea that any violation of the law is a violation of the entire law. So So after his tutelage under Gamaliel, Paul became a Pharisee, and he was rapidly advancing in stature, likely because of his high level of education. A little bit about the Pharisees. The Pharisees were founded as a response to the Hasmoneans. Now, the Hasmoneans are what we typically refer to as the Maccabees, after Judas Maccabeus, who was a priest and became a warrior and helped run out the Seleucids, the Greco-Roman rulers of the 3rd and 4th century BC over Jerusalem and Judea. Now, the Pharisees were basically founded because they opposed the Hasmoneans replacing the priestly line of Zadok with their own. You see, the high priest had descended from a high priest named Zadok for centuries. The Hasmonean family were priests, but they were not of the high priestly line of Zadok. And so the Pharisees were founded basically to oppose this. The Pharisees were seen as champions of the people, while the priests and later Sadducees were capitulating to the Romans in order to gain favor and honestly to keep their country relatively independent as much as they could. In many respects, Jesus as a rabbi was much more at home with the Pharisees than the Sadducees. As I've already said, they had much more what we would say are biblical positions on things. They believed in the resurrection. They had stricter views on divorce. Jesus kind of was a Pharisee. So, you know, he castigates the Pharisees, but I think it's because he's closer to them in his outlook, and they are closer to him. Now, the reason why I'm talking about this is because it's going to come up a little bit later in the story with how the trouble started in Galatia. But, you know, the Pharisees get a bad rap, and they should. Jesus pulls no punches. He minces no words. But we have to remember that the Pharisees would have been closest to Bible-believing Christians in that day. And the criticism is very harsh because, well, they're the ones who ought to be behaving rightly, given their stances on the scriptures and theology. Now, after Paul had risen in the ranks, he began to persecute Christians, arresting them, having them handed over to beatings, which we would say torture, and death. At some point, Paul obtained papers from the high priest to persecute Christians in Damascus. Now, Damascus was a different jurisdiction. It was in the province of Syria. Now, Paul was from Syria, so maybe that's why he was chosen. But the reason why they could do this is because the Roman government had given the Judean leaders a certain amount of independence with regard to the sanctity or maintaining the sanctity of their temple. There was a dispensation given to the high priest that they could protect the sanctity of their temple, and they could do it across jurisdictional lines. So Paul is really testing this Roman dispensation, this little known aspect of Roman law, by going to a different jurisdiction, Syria, in order to persecute Christians. While he was on the road, as you probably know the famous story, Paul was struck down by a blinding light. He hears the voice of Jesus saying, "Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me?" Saul says, "Who are you, Lord?" And the voice says, "It is Jesus whom you are persecuting." This is recorded in Acts chapter 9. Jesus tells him to go to Damascus and to stay at a house on State Street. And there a brother named Ananias will come and pray for him. Paul has something like scales that cover his eyes, and so he's blinded. Some people think that his thorn in the flesh was a vision impairment, but we'll never know till we ask him and we get to heaven. When he gets to Damascus, he is visited by Ananias. The Lord appears to Ananias about the same time, tells him to go to find Paul. Ananias is scared. He tells Jesus, look, this guy is trying to kill us. And Jesus says, it's okay. I have chosen him to be my instrument among the Gentiles. So Ananias goes and he prays for Paul. And as soon as he does, the scales fall from his eyes, which has become a common phrase now, meaning someone is all suddenly able to see or understand something. The scales fall from his eyes. He's able to see and he rises and is baptized, most likely by Ananias, but the text doesn't explicitly say. After his baptism, he immediately begins to preach the resurrection and messiahship of Jesus in Damascus. In doing so, he causes quite a stir. There was a very large Jewish population in Damascus, and going into the synagogues and preaching this was quite controversial. So the authorities didn't like this uprising, and so they pursued him to arrest him. But the disciples, the Christian disciples there, lowered Paul from the city walls in a basket so he could come to safety. After this, as we are told in the book of Galatians, Paul spent 3 years in Arabia. Now, that's a broad term. Where was it? Well, there was a kingdom called Nabatea. The Nabataeans were Arabians, and it was just to the east of Syria, Damascus. In fact, the kingdom of Nabatea would have been like a day's walk from Damascus. The kingdom stretches far south to the Persian Gulf. Sorry, the Red Sea. And so some people think that a part of this three-year period was Paul going to Mount Sinai. That's pure conjecture. Could be. We don't know. Was he spending the time fasting and praying, hearing from the Lord? That seems like a good guess. Probably spending the time preaching, doing ministry, honing his message among the Nabataeans. At any rate, after 3 years, Paul went up to Jerusalem, he tells us this in Galatians, to meet with Peter. Apparently, he wanted to meet with Peter in order to get some facts straight about liturgy, sacraments, and probably parts of Jesus' biography. He is introduced to Peter by Barnabas, who come up later in the story. He spends some time with Peter, apparently also is introduced to James, the Lord's brother, but doesn't meet any of the other disciples. He also apparently was preaching. Now, this seems to contradict. He said, I didn't know anybody, and they didn't know me by name. So the explanation is likely that he was preaching amongst the Greek-speaking Jews. Therefore, the church, the Hebrew-speaking church, didn't know him. That's a good explanation, and we'll go with it. His preaching again stirs up trouble in Jerusalem, and so he is sent away by the leaders, Peter and James. He is sent away to Syria and Cilicia, which is Paul's home. That's where he's from. He's basically sent home to Tarsus for his own safety. And there we assume he was preaching and praying and studying and so forth. A little while later, the church in Antioch wanted to begin a mission to the Gentiles. And so Barnabas, who had been dispatched to Antioch to lead that church, dispatched by the apostles to lead the church in Antioch and help them, Barnabas went to Tarsus to get Paul because he felt, maybe the others felt too, that Paul was the perfect person to help lead this mission to the Gentiles. Barnabas goes and gets Paul. They go back to Antioch, and the church there sends them on their first missionary journey. Along this journey, Paul preaches in the area of southern Galatia. Now, this is a good time to talk about the two theories about the recipients of the letter of Galatia. There are two theories. One is the northern theory, and the other is the southern theory. The northern theory is that the letter of Galatians is written to ethnic Gauls, Galatians, which are Celts. Celts lived all over Europe. If you've ever visited Europe, you'll know this. There's Celtic artifacts and buildings all over the place. Yes, they were largely dispensed to the northwest corner of Europe in the British Isles, but apparently some of them also lived in Asia Minor, which is modern-day Turkey. So was the letter of Galatians written to ethnic Galatians? There are some who think this, but I think that is not likely. The reason is that ethnic Galatians lived far north in Galatia. That's why it's called the Northern Galatian theory. And the reason why I think it's not likely is there's no recorded instance of Paul ever going there. Galatians seems to be built on the presumption that Paul had delivered the gospel to them at first. Now, some would argue that hold the Northern Galatian theory that it is Paul's unfamiliarity with the Galatians that has led to the ease at which they were led astray. That's a good theory, but I think the Southern theory stacks up a little better. The Southern Galatian theory is the one that I've been teaching in the sermons, is that Paul wrote the letter to churches that he established on his first missionary journey in what would be called the southern part of the Roman province of Galatia. There were four cities mentioned in Acts that he and Barnabas evangelized in this area. They were Lystra, Derbe, Iconium, and Pisidian Antioch. So I think, and a lot of scholars would agree, that Galatians was written to these four churches that were established in the first missionary journey, as recorded in Acts. So, Paul visits these areas, establishes churches. Now, 14 years after the original visit to Peter, which occurred 3 years after his conversion, at what point after the establishment of the churches in Galatia did this occur? Not clear, but probably pretty quickly, maybe within months. Paul took Barnabas and Titus to Jerusalem to meet with Peter, James, and John. This is what is discussed in the second chapter of Galatians, as we talked about in the sermon last week. The reason why they went up was not to gain some sort of stamp of approval. Paul makes this point very clear in Galatians. He did not get his apostleship from Peter, James, and John. He did not get his message from Peter, James, and John. He did not get a stamp of approval from Peter, James, and John. As I talked about in the sermon, the best theory as to why he went up, by the way, whenever we talk about going to Jerusalem, it's in the Bible, it's always going up to Jerusalem and going down everywhere else. That's for theological purpose, but also because Jerusalem is on top of a mountain. So the reason why Paul went up with Barnabas and Titus, I detailed in the sermon, is because Paul was concerned to preserve the unity of the church. This thing about Greek people coming into the family of God without being circumcised or following the laws of Moses was a potential firestorm. And Paul, when he says about having run in vain, I think he's having run in vain was because if he were to split, that the church would have split apart, it would mean that everything was in vain. I think it's the best explanation for why Paul went up, in order to preserve the unity of the church. Now, at some point after this, maybe soon after, maybe it was happening at the exact same time, some Judaizing Pharisees went down from Jerusalem to make their way to churches. And they made their way eventually to the churches of South Galatia, spreading a heresy. The heresy that we find described in Galatians, that heresy doesn't seem that the Gentile converts have to obey every jot and tittle of the law of Moses, but they should at least make a perfunctory and outward attempt at doing things that will not scandalize other people, maybe, or at least mark them culturally as Jewish people. That's probably a good guess. And so they were saying that they have to be circumcised, they should keep holy days, and they should adhere to the food laws. These Pharisees essentially were believers in Jesus as his Messiah and in his resurrection, which was not difficult, as I already told you, because their beliefs line up with Jesus's pretty well. It wasn't that hard for some Pharisees to believe in Jesus as Messiah and in the resurrection, and then just add that to their set of beliefs and teachings in Pharisaism. So this is probably the kind of people that are coming up that are scandalized by the message of free grace without adherence to the law of Moses that Paul is preaching in various places. And so they go up and telling people, as I've stated in the sermons, that Paul is, he got his gospel from Peter, James, and John, and he has perverted it. He has changed it to make it easier for the Gentiles. He has given them what we call an easy believism, where you just believe and you don't have to do anything, or a bait and switch kind of gospel where they are told that they only have to believe, but later they're going to be told that they actually have to obey parts of the laws of Moses. So they tell the people that they come from Peter, James, and John, and they have the authentic religion, and that's their heresy. They're adding to the gospel works of righteousness, works of adherence to Torah, and so that salvation is not by grace alone, through faith alone. Now, these Pharisees were spreading this message, and when Paul hears of it, he writes the letter of Galatians. He fires it off. It is a quickly written letter, and their companions around him. One theory, and I think this is a pretty good one, is that Paul was actually on the way to Jerusalem when he wrote this letter for the Jerusalem Council. Now let's talk about the Jerusalem Council. Some people, in order to make some of the dates work for them and their construction, would say that this letter was written after, that the visit referred to where he visits Peter, James, and John was the Jerusalem Council visit. I think that is highly unlikely, because if Paul had the decree of the apostles in hand, why wouldn't he say so? This would make his case much better than his, you know, claim that he had received the revelation directly from Jesus. No, I think that this letter was written before the Jerusalem Council. It's possible, as I said, that it was written on the way to the Jerusalem Council, but nonetheless, it was written before it. That places the letter about 48 AD. It is one of the earliest letters that are books in the Bible. But it's possible that Mark, maybe Matthew, were written before this or around the same time, but it's pretty early, 48 AD, only 18 years after Christ's death. All right, we got a little bit of time to talk about manuscripts. So we have a Bible in our hand that's translated into English, but this English translation is based off a Greek text. The Greek text is based off of actual physical manuscripts that are contained in libraries throughout the world. These manuscripts are collated according to their contents, the words that are in them, and a critical edition is produced like would be of any other ancient text. If you read any ancient text, Latin, Greek, otherwise, there's going to be a collation and a critical edition that is produced that gives the scholar's best guess of what the original text was. Now, we have a very good certainty, or close to certain, near certainty, that the text of the Bible that we have is accurate, because we have so many manuscripts, so many manuscripts, thousands upon thousands. So I want to talk about the evidence of the Galatians, letter to the Galatians. The letter is attested to in three ancient papyri. Papyrus is paper made from reeds. It is very brittle. It doesn't last, especially 2,000 years, but we have fragments of them, and I'll talk about some of these fragments. So three papyri, P46, P51, and P99. P46, or Papyrus 46, is also called Chester Beatty number 2. Chester Beatty is a collection of manuscripts that is contained in the Chester Beatty Library in Dublin, Ireland. Papyrus 46 dates to between 175 and 225 AD. They can date these letters based on what is called paleography, which is the study of ancient handwriting. They understand the trends by comparing them to other documents where the date is known, and they are able to pretty accurately date these things. So the oldest text of Galatians dates to the late 2nd century, the late 100s. That's pretty old. Papyrus 46 is only a fragment. It contains parts of chapter 6 of Galatians, but it is a witness that Galatians existed that long ago. The fragment that contains Galatians is contained in the Chester Beatty Library in Dublin, Ireland. Some other parts of the Chester Beatty collection are contained in other libraries. Papyrus 51. Papyrus 51 is also called Papyrus Oxyrhynchus or P. Oxy 2157. The Oxyrhynchus papyri were discovered in a trash dump in Egypt in the late 19th century. Can you imagine finding all these biblical texts and other ancient texts in a trash dump? Papyrus 51 contains parts of the first chapter of Galatians. It is dated to the 4th century, to the 300s. So we have the 300s papyrus that contains the first chapter. We have from the 100s, sorry, yes, from the 300s we have a part of the first chapter. From the 200s, maybe even 100s, we have part of the 6th chapter. Papyrus 51 is located in the Ashmolean Library at Oxford, so you can go there and see it. Papyrus 99 is an interesting text. It seems to be a glossary or just a set of different texts that are written down, maybe as an academic exercise. It dates to about 400 AD, and it contains snippets of Galatians from chapter 1, 2, and 3. It dates to, as I said, 400 AD, so the early 5th century. It is also located at the Chester Beatty Library in Dublin. So these are the ancient papyri that attest to Galatians. They only contain fragments, but the next group of manuscripts I'm going to tell you about contain the entire letter, and they date to the 4th and 5th centuries. The Codex Vaticanus originally contained the entire Bible. It dates to the early 4th century. It's one of the great Bibles. There were, according to historical tradition, 70 Bibles commissioned by Constantine. That contain the entire Bible, and this Vaticanus is one of them. It originally contained the entire Bible, but now it has lost some portions that have fallen off over the years. The Codex Vaticanus, as the name suggests, is located in the Vatican Library in Rome. It has the entire text of Galatians. It's all there. The reason why they last is because they're written on animal skin, not papyrus. The codices, so that lasts a lot longer. Leather lasts a long time. The second one is the Codex Sinaiticus. It contains also, originally, the whole entire Old Testament and New Testament, but now some of the Old Testament is missing, but it still contains the entire New Testament. The Codex Sinaiticus dates also to the mid-4th century, 300s. It has the entire text of Galatians. The section containing Galatians is in the British Library in London. The Codex Ephraemi originally contained the entire Bible, but portions are lost. The Codex Ephraemi is an interesting manuscript. It is what we call a palimpsest. A palimpsest is a text written on vellum, leather, animal leather, that has been erased. So the original text is erased. The original text was the Bible, and then someone came and erased it. Vellum is expensive, and so they would not throw it away. They would reuse it, and they reused it by scraping off the top layers of cells. Remember, vellum is skin. And then once the top layer of cells is removed, they can write over it. Now, we can read these palimpsests using X-ray photography, and so this has been done in the case of Codex Ephraemi. X-rays were used in order to see the original contents of the manuscript. The Codex Ephraemi dates to the 5th century, so 400s. It has Galatians, but not the first 20 verses of the first chapter because some of the leaves fell out. But other than that, it has the entire letter. The Codex Ephraemi is located in the Bibliothèque Nationale de France in Paris. Lastly, the Codex Alexandrinus contains the entire Bible with just a few pages lost. The Codex Alexandrinus dates to the first half of the 5th century. It is located in the British Library in London as well. It contains the entire text of Galatians. As the name suggests, the Codex Alexandrinus was discovered in Alexandria, Egypt. Now, why do we go through all that information about manuscripts, papyri, codices? Essentially, the reason is this. This helps increase our confidence in the message that we have before us, that it is well attested from the most ancient copies that we have. In fact, there are virtually no scholars, liberal, conservative, critical, there are virtually no scholars who contest the authenticity of Galatians, that it was written by Paul, that it was written in the 40s AD. These things are not contested. This is rare for a biblical book that no one would contest it. Of course, when we're talking about conservative Bible-believing scholars, they would not contest the authenticity of any of the books of the Bible. But what I'm talking about is liberal, critical scholars that do contest many of them, their authenticity, their date, etc. With Galatians, no one does. And I think this is important to consider, because if we take this as then an established fact, because if people could contest it, they probably would. That means that there was a man named Paul. He asserted several things about his story in this letter. Now, the liberal critical scholars would probably not agree that Paul received a vision. They would explain it some other way. But listen, if we're going to be Christians and we have a book of the Bible and we have a story there that is attested to be authentic, whether he's lying or not, it really affects the way we look at the Bible in general. If Paul is not telling the truth, this is an authentic letter written by the actual person, Paul of Tarsus. If he's lying, then what basis do we have? Or if he's deluded, then what basis do we have for believing anything in the Bible? I think we have no basis for any of it being true. And if Paul were lying, wouldn't we expect to have counter arguments surface somewhere? Texts that state, you know, Paul didn't really experience these things. He made it up. We simply don't have them. The pseudo-Christian texts that we have, the other writers like Josephus and other contemporary writers, they don't challenge Paul's authenticity that I'm aware of. So where does this place us? This places us with a story where much of the biography of Paul is articulated authentically by Paul, where he claims to have received a revelation, where he claims to have received a vision directly from the risen Lord. He doesn't tell the Damascus story in detail in Galatians, but there are enough of the main points of it, allusions to it, that leads us to believe that the story in Acts chapter 9 is authentic as well. And if that's true, if this man Paul did have an encounter with the risen Lord on the Damascus Road, this, I think, is one of the most impactful reasons to believe that the rest of it is true. The rest of the Bible is true. The rest of the story is true. The resurrection, as I said before, the resurrection of Jesus is one of the most central, it is the most central tenet in Christianity. But it's hard to prove. Essentially, our proof is that there were people who wrote about seeing him. There were people who died because they believed it was true, and because we don't have a body. Now, those are good reasons to believe. But the resurrection of Jesus is one thing that, if it's true, as I've been saying, If it's true, nothing else matters. And if it's not true, nothing else matters. But the story of Paul here has much more historically verifiable information. And I think, as I've been reflecting upon Paul's story and upon Galatians, I think because there's virtually no scholar that would contest the authenticity of Galatians, that Paul wrote it, and he wrote it in 48 AD. And the stories that he tells, the encounter with the risen Lord, the historicity of Paul, the historicity of this letter, the historicity of the encounter on the Damascus Road, that's verifiable. And I think that leads me to have more confidence because those things are more historically verifiable, essentially because Paul was a Roman citizen. He was multicultural. He was cosmopolitan in a sense. He walked and talked within and around and through the powers that be, both in the Jewish world and in the Roman world. He's much more of a historical figure, you might say. That's not taking away from Jesus' historicity. I'm saying in history, Paul is much more documented. And it's harder to challenge the fact that Paul existed. In fact, I don't think anybody would, and that he wrote Galatians, and I don't think anybody would. So here's my point. If that's true, and it seems like it is, because not even liberal critical scholars would challenge it, Paul really did have a revelation from Jesus. Paul really did get struck blind on the road to Damascus. And if that's true, then that means Jesus has risen from the dead. There's no other explanation for what occurred to him, that Jesus did rise from the dead. He did appear to Paul. He did give him his message. He did give him his apostleship. And all of the things that we read in Galatians verify this. I think this is a powerful reason to believe that the message of the Bible is true. That the living God who created the heavens and the earth became incarnate by the Virgin Mary and became one of us, a human being, fully God and fully man, that he lived a perfect life. He fulfilled the Mosaic law that Paul's been talking about. He died on a cross, executed by the Romans. He rose on the third day. He ascended into heaven. He gave us the true message of the Creator God. I think Paul's historically verifiable life and testimony means that all of that is true, that Jesus really is the representative of the living God, of the Creator of the universe. And if that is true, then that changes everything. And we really have no choice but to reckon with who he is, that Jesus is Lord, and he brings, as a member of the Trinity, fully God, brings the connection with the Creator of this universe to us through his life and through the ministry of the Holy Spirit. And I think that's why these manuscripts matter. This historical verification of the texts and the stories, all the details that I've been talking about in this podcast, because they help firm up the fact that what Paul is saying really happened. It is true, and that really means that the rest of the Bible is true as well. That's our podcast for this midweek. We hope that you will continue to join us in this series on Galatians as we continue. This Sunday, we will dive into the latter part of chapter 2, which is Paul's theological premise or thesis for the entire letter. Salvation, justification is by grace alone, through faith alone. We hope you'll join us.
Thank you for listening to this week's podcast. Please rate and review us on your podcast service and share with anyone who may be interested. The intro and outro music for the New Life podcast is provided by Sandra McCracken with her permission. Please visit her website at sandramccracken.com. We'll see you next week.